Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
Well, the Trump administration well underway into that first 100-day magical period people seem to think about, at least ever since Reagan's days. And so we want to take a look at what it might look like going forward and how far the new president has come already in reactions to what he's doing. So joining us is Professor Ben Epstein from DePaul University, always with his insights, always appreciated. Ben, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
So at this point, the cabinet is moving along. I don't think as we talk now, they're not all approved. But, I'll ask you, do you think they all eventually get through?
It looks like almost all of them will surely go through. There are a couple possibilities. I think that Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos had a pretty rough start, and there might be some big pushback against her.
But with regard to her, it doesn't seem to me as though the Republican senators, I'm just going to be blunt, don't seem to care much about that particular role, that particular topic with everything else on their agenda, which is my point for saying they'll let it go.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I would be surprised. I would be surprised if any of them are ultimately held up. I think that there might be more of a stand against a couple, but ultimately you need at least a couple Republicans to vote against. And while she may be a good option, it also might not. I don't think it's necessarily the conflict that a member of Congress wants to, or a member of the Senate wants to pick with the new president at this time.
Rex Tillerson gets through. Many people thought, you know what, Marco Rubio might just show some guts here.
Yeah,
and because based on his questioning, he was not going there. And then he went there, which leads me to ask the question, was that all about pressure from the White House? A. B. It's all political theater anyway. C. Both of the above.
I tend to vote a little bit of both, but I think it's more the political theater. You know, I think that Rubio did ask good pointed questions and can always say that he did. And it's also, I think, fair to say that you can ask tough questions and still be okay with the nominee. We see that, you know, in different contexts at the Supreme Court, asking really tough questions and then ultimately going along with that side of a particular case. So it may be a lot of good theater for Rubio, but ultimately, without his opposition, Rex Tillerson is through. And I think that if that was the major point of contention through many of these hearings from a prominent Republican, you're not likely to see too many others, over the next week or so.
Tom Price also getting a hard time from Democrats. That guy knows how to answer questions, maybe because he's already a member of Congress. But, you know, every single question posed to him, whether by Senator Claire McCaskill, Senator Ron Wyden, I mean, all these questions trying to get him to say yes or no. Will people who lose their Obamacare be OK? And never a straight answer. And I guess the reason may not be because he doesn't want to say no or didn't want to say no. It may just be because he just doesn't know what the plan's going to be.
I think that that's true. I think it's very clear that while Trump has said that they're going to be pushing forward with their new version of healthcare, their proposal very, very soon, it's absolutely clear that they don't have it organized right now. Tom Price has a plan that he had already created. Apparently, Republican leadership in the Senate and the House also have a different version that they're close to releasing. But nobody seems to be ready right now, and I think that it's probably safe for him to keep it vague at the time.
You know, and not that we are healthcare experts on this, Ben, but I do wonder. As you look forward to what's coming, I mean, it would be dangerous for the Trump administration. First of all, the president has made it clear repeal and replace will happen basically simultaneously. So he says. So he has promised.
That's what he said, right?
That's what he says. And then secondly, I can't imagine that a Republican-controlled legislature, whatever they do, will produce 20 to 30 million people who simply lose their health care. They may try and spin it as, no, no, they still have access to it. They just can't afford it.
Right.
Where do you think this ends up in terms of just a conclusion? I'm not asking you particular policy pieces,
sure.
But does everybody ultimately find a way to save? Is this going to turn out to be a fix to Obamacare, which probably should have happened in the first place, but Republicans wouldn't do it?
There's so many, you know, interesting parts of that question. I think that Democrats, Barack Obama, would have said over and over again that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is not perfect, and that there are improvements that could be made, and that you know, subsidies could be changed, and there could be, you know, better, you know, there are arguments on all different sides. This is, you know, the modern day definition of a third rail, that to remove this major program that affects so many people is you know, politically explosive. And I think to repeal and delay, or repeal and have some sort of you know, lack of clarity about what's going to happen, is a really dangerous position for Republicans and a dangerous position for Trump. I think it's just as dangerous to try to produce something quickly that's not well thought out, because this is a very, very complex series of policies that are intertwined to do a lot of things on an economic front in terms of the individual mandate and a lot of other things, and then also in terms of healthcare and in terms of insurance. And so this is a really dangerous game to be playing, and I shouldn't call it a game, but it's a difficult and dangerous thing to propose. It's going to happen so quickly without clearly knowing exactly what that's going to be. There are so many parts of Obamacare that are very, very popular in and of themselves, and together, Obamacare has, there have been recent studies that have shown it's never been more popular. So the threat of removing this is what's actually being shown to show that it's more popular than most people had thought or shown over the last few years.
In fact, ratings, at least the latest I've seen, puts the popularity at 49%. It hasn't yet broken 50%, but nevertheless,
right,
it's the highest it's ever been. And
right,
I think part of the problem is, or part of the what's happened, is that people are realizing that Obamacare and the Affordable Health Care Act, they're the same thing. They didn't know that.
Yes. Yes, and there are different names in various states. That there was a study I saw just, I think, a couple of weeks ago that showed the Tennessee name, which I'm not sure exactly what it was. People who overwhelmingly supported the name for the Affordable Care Act that was what the state of Tennessee had given it, but they overwhelmingly opposed it when it was called Obamacare. And so just not understanding that what they already have would be covered and would be threatened. And there are a lot of people also that have Obamacare or are covered under Obamacare and voted overwhelmingly for Trump, not really thinking that he would take it away, and not really thinking that ultimately this would be something that would be a target, because it affects so many people. So it remains to be seen. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and clearly, you know, you're right, because I don't think people's main driving force in the vote for Donald Trump at the election time was about Obamacare, although some would say it was. I think it was about the job climate. I mean, when you look, he won the Rust Belt states. He won areas where people aren't feeling good in the job climate. So we'll see what happens with health care. I mean, I think you're right. I think if President Obama changed anything, he may not be able to salvage Obamacare in terms of his legacy, but he certainly has made health care now being perceived as a right that people have, as opposed to something maybe we should get. And as you said, it may be like Social Security, a new third rail. And that in itself is an accomplishment.
Absolutely. I think that it will be virtually impossible politically to entirely remove the Affordable Care Act without catastrophic political consequences. That being said, what is built to fill that gap moving forward, and whether it's essentially a major tweak on the Affordable Care Act with a new name and different sort of framing remains to be seen. But you know, it originally came out of a largely Republican proposal, right? We know that Mitt Romney had something similar in Massachusetts. It's not something that should be as partisan an issue. And you're right. If this is now perceived, if health care and health insurance is perceived as a right moving forward, that's a major legacy claim for Obama.
Well, my guess is, it, in the end, may look a lot like Obamacare. It'll be called Trump Care, and therefore it will be okay. certainly with him and the Republicans.
Possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, listen, on the plus side, for those people who elected Donald Trump because he's going to be the greatest job creator known to mankind, which is a version of what he said about himself, he is out of the box that way. I mean, every day he seems to have me. He's got manufacturers in there. He's got the car manufacturers in there. So he is coming through. We'll see what happens. But it's not as though he made that a back burner issue. It's front burner.
Absolutely. Donald Trump deserves a lot of credit in terms of talking about and acting on the economy and on job creation. I mean, it's what he said that he has the most experience with, and he is doing it his way, but he's active. There's no question about that. Pulling out of the trade agreement and ultimately talking about making more individual deals, not only with other countries, but with individual companies. You know, it's a very hands-on approach. Whether that style is sustainable over the long run, I can't really say, but it's definitely something that he has done, and he's promised to continue to work to not only protect American jobs, but try to, create taxes and tariffs that ultimately will incentivize growth. And, whether it works or not, we'll see, but he's been active, no question.
On the international front, he plans to have his young son-in-law take care of all the problems in the Middle East that Henry Kissinger and others couldn't handle, but apparently young Jared Kushner can. That being said, as the discussion continues, though it appears to wane as to whether the U.S. embassy will be moved to Jerusalem, that would be pretty much a guaranteed way of assuring no success in the Middle East, right?
Yeah. Anyone who has seriously considered all of the complicated socioeconomic and political implications of that region understand that there's a reason why this has been an area of conflict, not for decades, not even for centuries, but for millennia. And we're talking about an incredibly complex series of interacting issues here. And if you're going to start out a reset by moving an embassy into a much more contentious area, it sounds fairly tone deaf to the sensitivities of the political realities on the ground there.
In terms of trade, TPP, kiss it goodbye. NAFTA, we've got the president of Mexico, I believe, coming soon. And it looks like Trump's approach to trade seems to be we're going to do this one-on-one, country by country. We don't need multilateral deals, multi-party deals. We're just going to take each country at a time. Now, I'm not an expert on trade either, but I just don't think the world works that way.
No, it doesn't work that way. But Donald Trump works very well that way. And so I think that by all accounts, he is very influential in person. He's very influential one-on-one. He's persuasive and he's persistent. And so I think that he understands where he is at the greatest advantage and understands that working out these deals is probably, at least in terms of how he's mapping out increasing leverage and increasing influence, is probably a great way to do it. But no, the world doesn't work that way. And there's, we have, international trade is not just in a two-way direction. That labor and products and different pieces of different assembly lines are all happening, all over the world. And it's a global economy. In many ways, it's a global political experience moving forward, as we sort of witnessed with the various marches this weekend as well. So there's a lot of things happening there, and I don't think that you can deal with every country one-on-one throughout the entire presidency.
It didn't take long until the first lawsuit got filed, calling for a violation of the Emoluments Clause. The bottom line is that now that he is president, the fact seems to be that as long as he owns properties around the world, and there's doesn't appear to be evidence yet that he no longer doesn't own those properties, but
right,
that he is in violation of the Constitution. He says these cases are without merit. We'll see what happens. But is this going to be a litigation-plagued, term in office just because of you can't take a businessman and pull him out of there completely and expect everything to go quietly while he runs the world?
I can't imagine that there's any other alternative. I think that there's going to be constant litigation here, partly because of how entangled he is with the ongoing affairs that are happening around the world with people that he is and now developing political relationships with and negotiating treaties with and trade deals and various other agreements. And so, yeah, I have a feeling like there will be constant ethics questions and cases brought up in court. It seems like there's I can't imagine that that would stop. Nothing that Donald Trump has done up until this point suggests that that he's trying to essentially throw everything that he has done to other people entirely. He's still going to be watching closely, and that's going to be a conflict moving forward.
He's a man who seems to live in front of the cable TV as well. And, of course, obviously we saw certainly in the opening days that, you know, questions about the attendance at the inauguration, anything that has to do with his image. He goes to the CIA. He talks about the attendance at the inauguration in front of the memorial wall. My question to you is, does Donald Trump ever accept the fact that he is the president of the United States and those are not the battles that need to be litigated anymore? Just, even if you agree with him, move on.
Yeah, of many things that have concerned a lot of people, I think the relative or maybe extreme thin-skinned nature of the current president is near the top, because any president, any politician, anyone in the public eye is going to receive a lot of criticism. And the first real press conference where there were questions that were asked of Sean Spicer, it became very clear that not only Sean Spicer, but more importantly, the president is offended or hurt by criticism, by the press doubting or wondering whether things are actually going to get done. And that's exactly what's going to happen on every day of every presidency. It's the nature of the job, and he is, Donald Trump seems to be constantly concerned about how much support he has and about going after those people who are criticizing him. And I think that the ongoing, you know, battle or conflict between most press organizations, most journalistic organizations, and the brand new White House is really staggering, and it speaks to what seems to be at the top of his priority list, which is his image. He's working hard. There are a lot of things that Donald Trump is doing well, but he really does need to focus more on getting things done and setting things up, which is an incredibly complicated process, and a little bit less on how many people were on the mall during his inauguration.
Right, which is why we're going to stay in touch with you on this topic. You are an expert in political communication, media, all things related to this. Professor Ben Epstein from DePaul University, Department of Political Science. As always, my friend, I thank you for being with me. We'll see you again both on the podcast and on television. Thank you.
I look forward to it, Paul. Thanks so much.
With so many incredible theaters in the Chicago area, in Chicago itself, I love finding particular theater companies which have a focus, which have a purpose, which try to change minds on a regular basis. And for me, the About Face Theater Company is one of those theaters. And so I wanted to introduce you to that theater. If you don't know it already, perhaps you already do. We're going to do that through the artistic director of the About Face Theater, Andrew Volkoff, who joins me. And also joining us is one of the stars of the current show that's running at About Face Theater called The Temperamentals, a play by John Marins. And he is, and I asked him to join me because I saw this play and all the actors are great. This guy just really hit me strong. And I said, please be a part of this. He said, yes. Lane Anthony Flores, who plays the role of Rudy, joins me as well. Andrew, Lane, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you for having us.
So, Andrew, let me start with you. The mission of the About Face Theater, I mean, some people just tag you, well, this is a, you know, gay, lesbian, LGBT kind of theater. And I don't think that does you justice to kind of just throw a category at you like that.
Well, thank you. I mean, our mission has always been to create adventurous theater and educational programming that advances the dialogue both here in Chicago and nationally on sexual and gender identity. And so, I mean, that could easily turn into something LGBTQ, but I think over the past 4 years, we've done a really solid job of kind of expanding what people's idea is of the work that we can present. So I'm glad to hear you say that.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're always. I've gone to the productions for years, and I've always found it to be, you know, educational. And in fact, when I saw the show recently, Chris Jones happened to be there. He was there for another show, but Chris is a friend. We began to talk, and so I knew what your review was going to be a little before you saw it, which I'm sure you have seen it. And of course, he loved the show and raves for everybody. And so, Lane, when it comes to you, you know, I mean, if people have heard of the Metachine Society, which is the basis of the Temperamentals, then they kind of know what's going on. Although my guess is some people might not realize till the end of the show, and if I'm ruining this, too bad, they should know better. these were real people. This is a real story. This actually happened in terms of the much of the content. Lane, talk to me a little bit about the plot of the Temperamentals and who you play. He was a real guy.
Yeah. So I play a character who's a real man named Rudy Gernreich. He was a fashion designer. Really started most of his design work in the late 50s, early 60s, and became famous around then, and was one of the founders of the Metachine Society, which actually was something I didn't know about going into the work. And before reading the play, I had never heard of the group before. And I don't think a couple of the other members of the cast, too, we were all learning so much while we were in the middle of rehearsals. But the story of the play is essentially the love story between Rudy and Harry Hay, who is really the man who thought up and created the idea of the Metachine Society, and how their relationship, you know, essentially gives birth to the movement itself.
So you're a relatively young guy, I think. And so how much of this – was this history new to you, or did you have it in your background, or were you learning as you –
You know, one of the lines in the play kind of talks about how most people think that LGBT activism really started with Stonewall, and I had always known that as kind of the baseline for gay history myself. But so this is, yeah, the Metachine Society, all of the history involved in this play wasn't something I was really familiar with or aware of before, you know, starting work on the text.
And striking when you come across it, I'm sure. Andrew, When you cast it, and you're a great person to talk about. The reason I went into this show specifically or in particular is because not only are you the artistic director for About Face, but you're the director of this show.
Correct.
So you get to wear two hats for this. So as you cast these parts, I'm assuming you were familiar with the history of all this. Not that you're older than Lane, what do I know? But although you are. But
that is true.
Yeah.
That is true.
But, so talk to me about the purpose of the selection of this play, what the message is that you wanted to get across. Because you do some interesting, I think, directorial kind of there's some decisions here that I think stand out. I'll talk about those, but give me a little bit of your thinking in terms of what went to the casting. Did you love Lane,
sure,
too?
Say that again?
You loved Lane, too, when you auditioned?
Of course. I was very lucky to get to work with Lane on our production of Abraham Lincoln a few years ago. So when he showed up into auditions, it was kind of like, well, this is a no-brainer. So I'm sure he's happy to hear that. But he knows how much I enjoy working with him. And
why, it's a Lane fest. It just became a Lane fest. I'm sorry.
I'll take it.
Yeah, totally, right? But I think, you know, I think when programming the piece, my intention was to do some education, to kind of share the history that is so often forgotten among gays and lesbians themselves, and share that with a wider audience. We do so much of our history as an LGBTQ community is oral, handed down from person to person, that it is often forgotten when people die, when people forget to share this information. So the great thing about this piece is it's kind of a living historical document of our past. I think it takes on a huge relevance in light of the current political situation. That was, you know, the silver lining, I suppose, in terms of the election this year. But
So tell me if this was in the script. There's a time in the show, it's actually a few times this happens, but where the cast kind of comes to the audience and the audience comes to realize we're not just an audience to this show, we're now actually part of the show. You know, we're sort of present, I hope I'm not ruining anything, but we're present sort of in this meeting. And in fact, at one point, and I have this in hand, you even pass out a little flyer called Victory, which was obviously something similar that might have been handed out back at that time. And people actually can take these things home with them, as I did.
Mm-hmm.
Are those director decisions? Are those in the script?
That's actually straight from the script. I think it's actually two. It's John Maron's choice to actually want to involve the audience in a more active way, so that they can be more present to what has come before and where they are now as people participating in the lives of these gay men and maybe the gay men and women in their own lives.
Lane, you're the person on stage interacting with the audience. At the performance I saw, it was a very receptive audience and, in fact, lots of applause. In fact, one gentleman kept applauding at things. I don't even know why this was anyway. Just lying. He was just really into it. But my question is, have you ever approached the audience and maybe had anybody kind of step back or taken aback and does it throw you at all? Does that not happen? Is it always that comfortable audience who gets what you're doing?
Not with this show yet, knock on wood. I mean, I've been in other productions where that can happen, and I, as an audience member, I'm always really hesitant when people come out into the audience and try and involve me. But with this one, everyone's been really receptive of everything that's happening. And I think, too, it just speaks to our political climate right now and the message of the show is just so powerful, especially at the moment you're talking about in the play. Is just, I always think, one of the most emotionally powerful moments of the whole evening. And so far, people have been really, really receptive to it.
Of course, by the way, we want to give a nod to the rest of the cast, obviously, Kyle.
Oh, yeah.
And Rob and Paul. You know, you're not doing this alone. You've got a group. But there's also, it's an interesting age disparity up on the stage. Some of the, cast are older and younger. And so talk to me about just a bit, Lane, the rehearsal process, everybody getting along. Did people kind of bring history to this rehearsal process, maybe encouraged by Andrew, or did it happen naturally?
Oh, yeah. No, there was a lot of discussing of, our own personal journeys and experiences moving through, figuring out our own viewpoints on both the politics and the gender identity elements.
When you come from Oklahoma, so that had to be interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting. But, I had a pretty easy time of it comparatively, especially when listening to some of the stories of some of my other wonderful cast members. It was it's always a very moving thing to share your personal stories when you're getting ready to work on, a work of historical fiction like this.
Yeah.
And seeing how it all really still relates and is still very vital and still very pertinent to the time.
Andrew, the Temperamentals, which, by the way, is playing, unless it gets extended, you stop me, but February 18th is going to be the date?
Correct.
Okay. And that's a hard end, right?
Well, as far as I know, I believe there's another show coming in directly after us.
Okay, so if not, people can check it out. But
exactly.
Within the season itself, you did have I Am My Own Wife, which I thought, by the way, was interesting. You also directed that.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that in the original production with Jefferson Mays, who wrote it.
Awesome.
Where he played all 740 roles in it, and you, of course, and again, a director's choice to cast several people in the different
Correct.
Roles, right? So I guess two questions. Number one, talk to me about that decision as opposed to one magnificent Jefferson Mays type. And secondly, how I Am My Own Wife, the Temperamentals, and we'll get to the next show, fit within a theme of this season.
Well, sure. I think my choice to open up the cast in I Am My Own Wife was primarily predicated on the fact that, Delia Kropp, a fantastic transgender actress here in Chicago, approached me about wanting to play the role. And I thought, well, as the artistic director of About Face, it's my job to make sure we're giving as many LGBTQ actors an opportunity to be seen on the stage. And I think for trans actors, those opportunities are few and far between. So consequently, I reached out to Doug Wright and I asked him, I let him know what we were cooking up here in Chicago. And he said, go for it. He was like, you totally have my blessing. The times have changed immensely from, you know, the time that I wrote it to now. So why not have a trans actress play a trans role? It's a no-brainer. But what that meant was adding a few people to the cast. And the great feedback we got from it was that so many people who had seen it before, as well as people who hadn't seen it before, it felt so fresh and alive and new to them, in a way that when one person is playing it, the story of Charlotta can often get a little subjugated to the virtuosity of having one person play.
Yeah, it brings challenges to its own. And by the way, I misspoke. I think I said Jefferson Mays wrote it as well. Of course, it was Doug Wright, but Jefferson Mays playing it in the original.
Totally. Yeah. Not a problem.
Yeah. So let me just, thematically, let me just, as I watch our time as well, Bright Half-Life is up next by Tanya Barfield. What's that show going to be all about?
Bright Half-Life is a great contemporary piece. Tanya Barfield is a sensational writer based out of New York City, writing a super piece about contemporary relationships. This one happens to be between two women, but I mean, I think what's kind of fascinating about the play and the themes that she's uncovering about love, infatuation, loss, long-term relationships, is that everybody that you know, whether you're in a new gay marriage, whether you're in a long-term committed lesbian relationship, whether you're an ally, you've gone through these experiences. And she uses a technique of bouncing back and forth through time without signaling where you are, because her conceit is that when you're in a relationship for a long period of time, there are things that remind you of things that happened in the past, and those things that happened in the past echo things that will happen in the future. So it's really kind of like taking a tilt-a-whirl or skydiving through someone's relationship over the course of 15 years. It's a beautiful, beautiful, contemporary, heartwarming piece.
And the opening day for that show will be?
Oh, my gosh.
All right, I'll tell you, May 26th. I was trying to give you a break and let you say it. May 26th to July 4th. You give the artistic director a chance. So that's the date for it. I also want to mention, while we have a moment, the Wonka Ball. That's where you guys make your money for the year, Friday, April 21st, right?
Friday, April 21st. We are just on the edge of determining our theme, as well as trying to nail down some honorary co-chairs, which should be pretty exciting.
Well, we should call it just We Love Lane. Why don't you just say that would be the theme?
Lane, you up for that?
So do I still have to buy a ticket to go?
Yeah. What do you think your salary is going towards?
I haven't answered that question yet.
I love it. Listen, you can find out more about the About Face Theater Company, which is just, I think, doing such important, and I'm saying educational work. I mean, it is part of the mission. People have to be educated. It's how things move forward in society. And the website is aboutfacetheater.com, with theater spelled the proper way, by the way, T-R-E. At the end. I'm very British that way.
I appreciate your saying.
Oh, my God. That
I agree
that
with you.
T-E-R is so plebeian, isn't it? Anyway, it's About Face Theater, T-R-E. Now, no one's going to forget that. And the phone number is 773-975-8150. Located now at Theater with Box Office. It's on Belmont. We've talked about a couple of things in that area, which is great. And the next show looks to be great. Honey West was on the show a couple of weeks ago talking about.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, doing Priscilla. So it's just great to see the expansion of Chicago talent and what they're doing. And Lane Anthony Flores, Oklahoma's loss is Chicago's gain. I hope you're going to hang around here.
Oh, yeah. I'm not going anywhere.
All right. And at least not back to Oklahoma. And I'm sorry, I shouldn't. You know, it's a lovely state. And Andrew Volkoff, the AFT Artistic Director and Director of so many shows that we see there. Thank you for being with me. It's About Face Theater. Don't miss the temperamentals. It's a superb show. It really is. Chris Jones, he absolutely loved it. And people ought to check out your entire season. And I thank you guys for being with me.
Thank you so much for having us, Paul.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's P-A-U-L-L-I-S-N-E-K. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And, hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.